Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the clashes inside and outside the University of Illinois Chicago Pavilion on March the 11th between supporters and opponents of Donald Trump that will either boost Trump's appeal or be a turning point in the frontrunner's gathering momentum towards the Republican presidential nomination. Steve Chapman, a columnist and editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune, whose twice-a-week column on national and international affairs appears in 50 newspapers across the country. He joins us to discuss his latest article at the Chicago Tribune, Donald Trump's Dangerous Antics Prove He's No Leader, and how Donald Trump is doubling down on his attacks on what he calls disruptors, which he blames on our communist friend Bernie Sanders, whose rallies Trump is now threatening to disrupt. Then we'll look into authoritarian personalities in politics as they relate to the rise of Donald Trump and speak with Jonathan Weiler, the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, the director of global studies at the University of North Carolina. He joins us to discuss the extent to which next Tuesday's vote will be a referendum on whether America will turn to the dark side of politics or the better angels of our nature will emerge in this polarized and overheated election year. Then finally, we'll get an assessment of how the peace talks on Syria are being implemented on the ground as the al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front seizes bases and U.S.-supplied weapons from the Western-backed Free Syrian Army, including U.S.-made TOW anti-tank missiles. Rafif Jujati, the founder and director of the Free Syria Foundation and the English-language spokeswoman for the opposition's local coordinating committees in Syria, joins us to discuss charges by the U.S. and France that the Syrian government is trying to disrupt the new round of peace talks. And joining us now is Steve Chapman, a columnist and editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune, whose twice-a-week column on national and international affairs appears in some 50 newspapers across the country. His latest article at the Chicago Tribune is Donald Trump's Dangerous Antics Prove He Is No Leader. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Chapman.
Nice to be here.
And Steve, what's your sense in terms of whether or not this fateful vote on Tuesday, indeed, if it is a fateful vote, it does seem to be that at this point we don't know whether the visuals of people screaming and punching each other, how that will play in terms of whether it will boost Trump's numbers and momentum towards the Republican nomination, or whether it will there'll be a backlash. What's your sense?
My guess would be that it's not going to hurt him, because I think the people who like Trump are only going to be reinforced in their sentiments from what they saw, what they've seen in the last couple of days. I think the people who were turned off by Trump, who had already decided to vote for Cruz or Rubio or Kasich, I think they'll be reinforced as well. So I would guess it's going to be pretty much a wash.
And the fact that those three tend to cancel each other out, that means that no majority can emerge, right? So he's got a clear path if this is the dynamic.
I really see no reason to think he won't get the nomination. I think he's confounded expectations time and again. He's proven he has a very solid plurality of support within Republican primary voters, and I really don't see that any of the three remaining candidates is going to drop out and give the other two or one a chance to take Trump on one-on-one.
So given that
they've all got, you know, they all have an idea of how they can win. I suppose if Kasich and Rubio lose their home states on Tuesday, they might get out. On the other hand, they may decide that it's better to have two or three people in the race against Trump rather than to take the chance that he could actually win a majority.
Well, I think one of the reasons why nobody's clamoring to find a substitute or get behind the obvious substitute that would be Cruz is that nobody likes him. So this is not an easy choice for the Republicans.
No, it's not an easy choice for the Republicans. I have to say Cruz has behaved with a much greater restraint and responsibility the last 48 hours than I would have expected. But he still, there is still an awful lot not to like about Ted Cruz.
And again, go ahead.
I mean, it's a really unpleasant choice if you're a Republican, I would think.
And since you've written that column, Steve, Donald Trump has doubled down. He's accusing our communist friend Bernie of instigating and being behind these so-called disruptors. And now he's charging or warning, or if not threatening, Bernie Sanders that he will disrupt his rallies. So could this thing get out of hand?
Oh, I think it certainly could get out of hand. And I think there's a danger that at future rallies of Trump's, that people are going to, when demonstrators show up, that the reaction is going to be more hostile and more violent than it's been even up to now, because now everybody who goes to a Trump rally knows that there are going to be disruptions, that there could be a lot of protesters, and I think that will draw out people who are really looking for a fight.
But in terms of who the so-called disruptors were, and we saw a lot on television and subsequent to last Friday's standoff and slugfest, I've heard a couple of the people involved in interviews, including the young African-American man who tried to seize the podium and was pulled away by the Secret Service. He said that what got him riled up was the extent to which he was told to go back to Africa, and the N-word was used against him. So I don't know whether we'll actually start capturing that stuff on camera, but what's your sense of whether – I mean, it seems pretty clear that this was at the university where you've got a lot of minority students, and I'm sure it's a coincidence rather than is it a plan that they support Bernie Sanders. What's your sense?
I think you're right. I think – there's a lot of anti-Trump sentiment, and it obviously overlaps to some extent with the pro-Sanders sentiment. But I don't think anybody who was at the Trump rally went there because they're a Sanders supporter. I think some of them may support Bernie Sanders because of the views they have that make them anathema to Trump. But I don't think that the Sanders campaign has anything to do with this. The Sanders campaign... Their main problem right now is Hillary Clinton, and you don't see them doing this at Hillary Clinton rallies. It's hard for me to see how Bernie Sanders gets anything in particular from this. So I think the people who love Bernie Sanders, they go to his rallies. The people who are angry about what Trump is proposing, they may go to Trump rallies to protest. But I think it's whether or not they support Bernie Sanders is really irrelevant to their presence there.
And what do you know about Trump's advance team? It seems like an odd choice. I understand he wanted to find a venue in the more conservative Chicago suburbs, but I believe that Cruz had a lock on one of the venues. Why did he choose a downtown venue in this multicultural city?
My suspicion is that he has people who are running the campaign who have just never done this before. And they're looking around for a traditional Trump event, you know, before he was in politics, the UIC Pavilion it would have been fine. It's convenient to downtown. It's convenient to mass transportation. It wouldn't be hard for people to get to. But it's the wrong choice in a political context because it's in the heart of the most, Democratic place in Illinois. If you wanted to draw Republican voters, you would go to Lake County, to McHenry County, to DuPage County. There are a lot of places you could go. Now, he may have had trouble finding one big enough, but I think that's a symptom of the inexperience of his advance team, his campaign staff. I think it probably didn't occur to them, this might draw a hostile crowd because of where it's located. I think they were just looking for a big crowd, and not having, done political events for very long, they didn't think it through.
So in terms of your latest column, Steve Chapman, Donald Trump's dangerous antics prove he's no leader. What is this? Neither of us are clairvoyants here, but in terms of the way the chips are going to fall on Tuesday, Obviously, a considerable number, if not a growing number, of Americans see him as a leader, in spite of the what we saw on television, which I think alarmed a lot of people. But of course, to us, this is a local election. To the rest of the world, it's a global election, and already there's a great deal of alarm being expressed. How do you think that case can be made for those people who find Trump alarming? How do you reach the people that see him? And after all, the people who support him, they're white, angry, working Americans, have lots of reasons and very legitimate grievances. And he is talking to them, to some extent also Bernie Sanders is. But you've got to give Trump credit for tapping into what is obviously very, very real grievances.
I think there's an element of real grievances, and I think there's an element of sort of mindless resentment of change and a sense of victimization that's unwarranted by the actual reality on the ground. I think, you know, the country is changing. A lot of people don't like it. A lot of people have never come into contact with Muslims before. And when they see that there are a lot of Muslims coming in, and they see that Muslim jihad is a problem overseas, they react in a very uninformed, knee-jerk way. I think he obviously appeals to people who have lost their jobs, who had once had good jobs in manufacturing plants, and those are gone. I don't think he has any answers. But I think there's always been an element in America of people who are paranoid and angry and hostile to change and indifferent to the fate of minorities. And you can mobilize a fair number of people if you can find a way to deliver a message that captures all those feelings. And he's obviously done that. I can't deny that he's been masterful at appealing to a certain segment of society, but I think the fact that there is that constituency out there doesn't mean that it's necessarily mostly made up of people with legitimate grievances.
Well, that's the alarming part of what took place on Friday night in Chicago was, according to the protesters that were there, they were incited by Trump supporters with the most reactionary racist epithets, not just the N-word, not just going back to Africa, but even, you know, things like you should be picking my cotton and stuff like that. I mean, it makes one... It surprises me that all of this idea that we're in a post-racial, post-cultural, post-gender society in terms of the millennial generation, the residue of racism seems to be alive and well.
Oh, I think it definitely is. And I think the reaction you've seen over the past 8 years to a black president has made that just inescapable. The terms you hear, I get hostile email from readers all the time, and the terms that you hear them use about Obama, and I'm not talking about overtly racist terms, I'm talking about sort of negative adjectives that, that he's arrogant, that he's a thug, that he's ceaselessly fomenting racial divisions, things like that, things that are just not recognizable in terms of anything Obama has done. I think there are a lot of people who see a black face in the White House and they associate black people with all these qualities that you don't see in President Obama, and yet they somehow manage to see it. That's obviously a residue of racial prejudices and hostilities that go back a long way.
Well, I've been saying for some time now that my sense of what triggered Trump to run, the inciting incident, as Hollywood screenwriters would have it, was the correspondents' dinner of a couple of years back when Obama had already given the order to kill bin Laden, and he made fun of Trump about his reality show, the difficult decisions that Donald has to make. And I don't know whether you recall the incredible anger on Trump's face and humiliation. The New York Times' front page today is suggesting that that did set him on his path. But either way, do you see this guy as really being serious? I mean, to my mind, he doesn't so much want to be president. He wants to win the presidency. It feels like a grudge match.
I don't think he really knows what he wants to do as president. I think he has some vague ideas, but I think he would be in way over his head. This is a guy who's been running for president for, 8, 9 months now, and he still has not gone into any detail about, you know, his actual policies that he's going to pursue in office. And when he's asked about things in debates, he just is incapable of giving an answer that shows any knowledge of the subject. The debate the other night when the subject of the Cuba opening came up, and it was obvious he had no idea what he wanted out of a deal with Cuba, and Marco Rubio he addressed the question, and this is a guy who knows what he's talking about. He's, you know, Cuban American. He's from Miami. He has thought about this issue a lot. He's discussed it a lot, and he really took Trump to school on that. And that sort of thing is disturbing because, it's very hard to predict what Trump would do. What does he do when he doesn't get Mexico to pay for his wall? What's plan B? Is he going to tear up NAFTA? That's the impression you get, but I've never heard him say that, and I've never heard him consider what all the fallout from that would be, not only with Mexico, but with Canada.
Well, I had a Canadian scholar on the other day who's a Trudeau fellow at the University of Montreal, and she made the joke that the Canadians are going to build a wall to stop all the Americans who are going to be fleeing Trump, and we're going to make the Americans pay for it. So just in the last minute or so then, Steve Chapman, since you're in Chicago, and that's where the scene of the crime was, if you will, on Friday night, Chicago, of course, is also infamous for the 1968 Democratic Convention that became a kind of bloodbath. There are some predictions now that Cleveland will be a bloodbath for the Republicans. And I noticed the conservative columnist in the New York Times today basically called for an effort, if you will, to block Trump at Cleveland. So what do you think that bodes for?
I would be very surprised if there's anything like that. I don't doubt that there will be a lot of people who will turn out to Cleveland to protest. But conventions have had, going back to 68, have had a lot of experience with. So the problem with conventions is not that they're too vulnerable to this sort of thing, but that they're so protected from this sort of thing that it's almost impossible for opponents to make their views known in a visible way. So I doubt there will be that sort of violence. And there were a lot of violent groups that were at the 68 convention, violent left-wing groups. There are not a lot of violent left-wing groups, groups that see violence as a way to change society. I think that's very much a thing of the past with the left.
Well, I think Uncle Bernie is not exactly a rabble rouser. I mean, he rhetorically he may be, but his followers aren't street fighting men.
No, I mean he would be Bobby Kennedy or Gene McCarthy. His people would be with those guys, not with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin.
Right. Well, Steve Chapman, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Steve Chapman, who's a columnist and editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune, whose twice-a-week column on national and international affairs appears in some 50 newspapers across the country. His latest article at the Chicago Tribune is Donald Trump's Dangerous Antics Prove He Is No Leader. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into authoritarian personalities and politics as they relate to the rise of Donald Trump.
You risk exciting me. Once in Germany, someone said nine. Once in Germany, someone said nine.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jonathan Weiler, who's the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He's the director of Global Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Weiler.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And Jonathan, you were on CNN this morning on Fareed Zakaria's program, and you were explaining the authoritarian politics in authoritarian personality in politics as they relate to the rise of Donald Trump. Obviously, you know, the word fascist is thrown around quite often irresponsibly, but it has emerged a number of times. There have been pictures of Donald Trump pouting alongside pictures of Mussolini, and there's an inescapable comparison there. But my sense is that we're not talking about American fascism so much as right-wing American populism. What's your feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree. I don't think we're talking about American fascism. I think for, you know, institutional and other reasons, that's not where we are. But certainly we are talking about a brand of right-wing politics, right-wing populism. You know, would be one way to say it. Right-wing authoritarianism, of course, would be another way to say it. And I do think that this is, you know, in some ways the apotheosis of a long-term trend in the Republican Party toward an increasing focus on a particular kind of us versus them politics that has been a breeding ground that Trump has really taken full advantage of.
So what's your analysis then going further into this idea that has often been expressed that the Republicans are reaping the whirlwind of what they've sown over the decades in terms of stoking white anger, not at necessarily at those who are responsible? And I think you can make a case that the case that, by the way, that Bernie Sanders makes is that the real villains in this country are the oligarchs who are basically living off the fat of the land. And the reason why everybody else is being downsized is that there is a maldistribution of income in this country. So if you're on the other side, if you're a Koch brothers or a plutocrat in this country, it would make sense, wouldn't it, not to just to distract people with bread and circuses and rile them up and blame them on minorities and foreigners and Muslims who want to kill us and all of this stuff that Trump is spouting?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this story in some ways, it goes back a long way. I think it goes back to the 1960s and the desire of Republican elites to do what all political parties want to do, which is win elections. And to do that, they needed to break the power of the New Deal coalition. And, you know, Richard Nixon had a young speechwriter and strategist named Pat Buchanan who began pushing him toward the idea that appealing to what were then would have been called white blue-collar voters, ethnic voters, we would have said, who were perhaps increasingly angry at the growth of crime in the streets and other signs of disorder in the 1960s. And those racial appeals and silent majority proved to be electoral gold for Nixon. And I think that set in train a process over many decades whereby the Republican Party began to appeal to a social order, a traditional social order that said all of these changes are undermining the fabric of America. And in doing so, unwittingly, I would say, they cultivated a base of supporters who happened to be sort of strongly authoritarian in their outlook. And so they cultivated the base that Trump is now speaking to.
But when you say these changes, what are we talking about? Is that Nixon's Southern strategy? When the Democrats and LBJ said when he signed the Civil Rights Act in 1965, he just said the Democrats are now going to lose the South, which they did. So
right. for a generation, he said. Yeah.
Yeah. So and then it's yeah. proven to be even more longer than that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I would say that's the beginning of a process. Absolutely, race, I think, is foundational to this polarization that's emerged so strongly in the United States over the last couple of decades. But then I would say the breakdown of traditional family structures, the rise of feminism. You know, in 1972, the Republican Party institutionally was as supportive of the ERA as the Democratic Party was. And by 1980, they were staunchly opposed to it. And then the rise of gay rights as an important kind of social rift, culturally speaking, in the 80s and 90s. And on every one of those issues, the Republicans took one side. And again, and I think in a way that appealed to a very particular worldview. So I think one of these things built on top of the next.
And of course, North Carolina, along with Illinois and Ohio and Florida, have the big vote on Tuesday. But just to continue on this track, if just to get a sense of, because we were talking earlier with the columnist with the Chicago Tribune about the nature of the rallies, disruptors, and those that were screaming at each other, which we all saw on television. Many of those young protesters who have been accused of being Bernie's surrogates were minority students from the university itself, where the venue was. And one of them, you know, they've all come forth and said, you know, we were called the N-word, we're told to go back to Africa, we're told to go pick cotton, and all of this incredible racism. So just to continue, it's no accident, of course, that Ronald Reagan chose the venue of Mississippi to announce his presidential race in 1980. And many commentators are making comparisons between the visuals of the clashes at Trump's rallies and George Wallace's rallies. So what do you make of that comparison?
Well, I think the Trump-Wallace comparison in particular is a very interesting and apt one. Both the kind of racial resentment that is clearly, and I guess an ethnocultural resentment, that is clearly core to Trump's appeal and obviously was core to Wallace's appeal, combined with, an economic populist message. And Ian, this raises a point that I just want to mention, which I think is interesting. You know, the book that Mark Hetherington and I wrote together, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, you know, what we found was that authoritarian-minded individuals, they didn't care about things like abortion. They did not feel strongly about that issue. They also didn't feel strongly about the small government agenda that's been such an important part of conservatism over the past generation. They really cared about policing social boundaries. They cared about they were worried about Islamic terrorism. They didn't like gay marriage. They showed strong signs of racial resentment. And so in those regards, Trump is a particularly an almost eerie fit for that profile and that worldview, different from other Republicans who are also very conservative, like his rivals in this particular race. And those other Republicans, by the way, I'm sure you've talked about this. I mean, I must say it kills me to hear Marco Rubio now painting himself as the voice of conciliation and civility when just a month ago he was bashing President Obama for daring to speak at a mosque. So to some degree, the Republicans are all just bathing in waters, these waters that they created a long time ago. But Trump is distinctive from that milieu in some of the ways that I just mentioned.
Well, he also is tapping into, I think, legitimate grievances about trade, downsizing, outsourcing.
Absolutely.
And also in terms of foreign policy, you know, Rubio is a dyed-in-the-wool neocon who wants to get us into a whole bunch of wars. Trump has a very different foreign policy prescription. If Hillary Clinton is the nominee, he'll be running to the left of her in foreign policy.
At least in some ways.
In some ways, yeah, of course. Yeah. But just back to this idea that plutocratic rule requires kind of bread and circuses, because you can't really, if you're the Koch brothers, you can't really tell the American people, although they try, that you're just going to work for more and more for less and less, and you're going to make us richer. That's the reality. You have to give them some other alternative. And frankly, I think it was pretty clear a turning point in America was under Ronald Reagan, where the statistics bear this out, that since the late 1970s, wages have been flat in this country, and that what happened was that Reagan and the chairman of the Fed, Greenspan, opened the floodgates of credit to encourage people to get hooked on credit, which they have done, which gave them the illusion that their standard of living was raising. And, of course, you probably recall, Jonathan, that there was a time not so long ago that banks actually paid interest. Now they charge up to 20% interest. Yeah. That's the big change that took place under Reagan.
Right. So a couple of thoughts about that, Ian. First of all, you know, I think the it's interesting about the plutocrats. I mean, the Koch brothers, I wonder if if Trump doesn't just make them very nervous. You know, so he's so unpredictable. And I'm not sure he's their ideal candidate. He doesn't share their small market agenda, and so he's an interesting kind of insurgent in that regard.
Well, I think they've made that clear. At least there have been enough leaks from inside the Trump. You know, they raised close to $1 billion. They got up to go against Hillary, and then suddenly Bernie Sanders is doing a pretty good job running against Hillary. So, you know, obviously this is even for the Trump brothers, this is an unpredictable political year, right?
Yes. And, you know, to your other point, Ian, just about the legitimate grievances of so many working Americans, that is, of course, true. And one thing it makes me think about is what happens to my co-author, Mark Hetherington, has written other books about trust in government in ways that I think are very interesting. And, you know, I think as a society becomes this riven by wealth inequalities, it seems to me that trust declines in all sorts of ways. Trust in institutions, trust in other people, trust in your own future. And that strikes me also as a breeding ground for the kinds of messages and the kinds of demagoguery that's really rising to the fore now.
But throughout this country,
and I guess,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, I guess just to finish the thought, and I think in some ways that's because there's a very strong feeling, legitimately so, that ordinary politics can't work anymore for the average person. And so you need someone or something extraordinary instead.
Well, I was going to say that there are cycles in American history of greater plutocratic control, and then it ebbs and flows into more democracy and pluralism. And, you know, you had the Gilded Age, and then the reforms under the Republican Theodore Roosevelt, and then the 20s it went back the other way, and then in the 30s and 40s it swung back towards more social democracy under FDR, and since Reagan it's moved back towards more plutocratic control or plutocratic influence. And isn't it logical, though, Jonathan, that when you say that there's a distrust in government, that, of course, has been the Republican mantra for the longest time, and going back to Ronald Reagan, who said that government's the problem. They've done a good job on demonizing the government, but in reality, the only checks and balance against the kind of income inequality that's growing in this country is the government itself. Who else can be the advocate for the people but the government?
Absolutely. And you know, further to your point, though the Republicans, of course, have declared war on government ideologically and philosophically and rhetorically and all of that, in reality, we know that there's 100 ways in which they've continued to prop up various kinds of government, right? Whether it's the Pentagon or police forces or the drug war, or most of them have not dared make too serious a run at Social Security and Medicare. So, you know, they have been walking a tightrope and playing a very dangerous game at the same time.
Well, that's why I think Trump is so much more clever than they are, and that's probably why they're so alarmed at him, if we're talking about the so-called Republican establishment, whatever that is, because Trump is actually in favor of Social Security, in fact, improving it. So, again, he's not playing by the old playbook.
No, he really isn't at all, and as you're suggesting, they have no idea what to do with them as a result.
So what's your sense then in terms of – I mentioned in the opening that we'll be discussing the extent to which next Tuesday's vote will be a referendum on whether America will turn to the dark side of politics, or – the better angels of our nature will emerge in this polarized and overheated election year. Do you see that? Do you see Tuesday's vote in those terms? Because frankly, we don't know whether following all of this ugly stuff on television that harks back to George Wallace, whether this is going to help Trump or hurt him.
Yeah. So you might accuse me of being delusionally optimistic. But I would say this. I would say it's important to keep in mind that Trump is really strong with Republican primary voters right now, which is unnerving and disorienting enough. But I think there's a lot of evidence that with the general population, he really is in some ways historically unpopular in terms of his unfavorable ratings, for example. There's a lot of evidence that women in particular can't stand the guy. I was talking to a political consultant last week who's been involved in focus groups, and he said the reaction that Trump gets from women is off the charts in a negative sense. And, of course, we haven't even discussed the degree to which he's alienated almost every person of color in the United States. So, you know, I want to believe that whatever else Trump has done, he has made it very difficult to, using this brand of politics, to construct a majority coalition in a November election.
Well, that's what seems to be happening in terms of his doubling down. He says that he's wants to be the president of all Americans, but when he pits one group of Americans against another, And now he's accusing Bernie Sanders, or who refers to as our communist friend, that he's instigated the whole thing. And obviously, these young protesters in Chicago at the university, you know, obviously it's a coincidence that they are angry at Trump and that they also support Bernie. You know, it's hardly a causal connection there. You know, he's now threatening to disrupt Bernie's rally. So, in other words, he's tearing the country apart, not uniting it. And that's not somebody that really has his eye on the general.
No, and it's interesting because he shows signs, very occasional signs, of pivoting. You know, he'll have his moments where even his tone changes and he's calmer and he says he wants to maybe rethink some positions, but it's almost as if he can't ultimately help himself. And so he says, who was it, to Anderson Cooper the other day, that Islam hates us. And so it does seem like as much as he's being portrayed in some quarters as this kind of strategic mastermind, which relative to the Republican nomination process he seems to have been, I don't know that that's going to translate very well. Again, maybe delusionally optimistic, but I think there are reasons to believe that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jonathan Wyler.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Wyler, who's the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He's the director of Global Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with an assessment of how the peace talks in Syria are being implemented on the ground. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Rafif Jujati, who's the founder and director of the Free Syria Foundation. She's also the English language spokeswoman for the Local Coordination Committees in Syria, a grassroots network designed to align the activities of pro-democracy Syrians in each of the country's 14 governorates. Rafif frequently travels to the Middle East, including Syria, and coordinates with other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rafif Jujati.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And both the United States and France are accusing the Assad regime of trying to disrupt this new round of peace talks by insisting that there won't be a presidential election. And then on the other side, on the ground, we have reports now that the Al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front are seizing bases and U.S.-supplied weapons, including TOW anti-tank missiles, from Western-backed groups such as the Free Syrian Army. So let's start with the latter. What do you hear about what's going on in terms of the Western-backed groups losing their weapons?
I haven't heard as much about the Western-backed group losing their weapons. What I have been hearing about is Russian and regime airstrikes and a renewed siege on the area of Al-Ward in Homs, despite a treaty that was signed by the regime and the Russians. And so what we're hearing today is that the city of some 90,000 civilians is being denied any food or medical assistance or any other humanitarian supplies. And in fact, they're being subjected to shelling and aerial raids. So this is more what I'm hearing than the other.
Well, these attacks, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, are taking place in Marat al-Numan in Idlib province. But in terms of the other point that the U.S. and France are now accusing the Syrian government of trying to undermine this round of peace talks, the sticking point appears to be, the accusation is that the Syrian government's backing away from agreements, which are presumably meant a presidential election, and now they're saying no, that Assad refuses to be challenged.
Right. Well, Assad refuses to be challenged, and the evidence of that is that we have some 400,000 dead. The evidence of that is that more than half the population of Syria has been displaced, either internally around the country or in Europe, the United States, and other areas. The Assad regime is hardly willing to negotiate itself out of a job, and what they have done pretty consistently in the past 5 years is refused to hear the voice of the Syrian people. The Syrian people are demanding regime change, they're demanding a dismantling of the Baath Party, and they're demanding a return to freedom and dignity and democracy. It's actually very simple that the Assad regime continues to stall and continues to try to enforce preconditions is simply an old tactic by now.
Well, the Assad regime, of course, is being propped up by the Iranians and by the Russians, and they looked like they were going to go under it fairly recently until Russia intervened. How do you do any polling? How do you know that these are the sentiments of the majority of the people? Because he obviously does have support, albeit they're running out of fighters. Most of the Alawite community the male population has been decimated in the fighting, and now they're relying on Hezbollah, Iranian and Russian troops to actually, in terms of boots on the ground, along with air power. So that's the sort of military situation. What evidence is there that, I would assume that most Syrians would recognize, because you don't have to be a genius to figure this out, most Syrians would recognize that this country's been destroyed by this one family who insists that it's their God-given right to run this place like a plantation and ad infinitum. I mean, it's inescapable that he's to blame, but I want to know how you know that this is the sentiment of the Syrian people.
Well, there are many, many indicators. Now, of course, it's virtually impossible to take an honest poll across the country, virtually impossible, because this is a country where even delivering medical assistance is a reason for the regime to target you and kill you if they don't imprison and torture you. But I will say, I can talk about a couple of things. First of all, in those areas where the cessation of hostilities did take hold, we saw massive, massive nonviolent protests where hundreds and thousands of people came out chanting for the removal of the regime, for a return to dignity, and calling for freedom. So this is one, and this is in the very recent past few days. The main slogans have been that the Syrian people are one, which means indivisible in an indivisible country. And the other slogan has been the revolution continues. So this is the first point. But the second point is that my group conducted a survey of more than 50,000 Syrians 2 years ago, and we're continuing the work. What we did was we put together a freedom charter, and it's a statement of what the Syrian people want. And the results of that survey of, again, more than 50,000 Syrians is they want neither Assad nor ISIS nor any other Islamist group. And what they want is truly part of the goals of the revolution. Again, freedom, dignity, and democracy for all Syrians.
But as this peace talks get underway, or have been underway, my sense is that the strategy on the part of the Russians and the Syrian regime is essentially to, and they've been targeting the non-jihadi opposition, which now we just learned they've just had their weapons seized by al-Nusra. So all along, it seems like the so-called moderate opposition has been hung out to dry. And this would then play into Assad's narrative that it's either me or the jihadis. So is Assad and the Russians trying to create that reality, which started out as rhetoric, but now is increasingly becoming a reality?
Well, I think this has been the strategy of the Assad regime since the very beginning. We need to remember that in 2011, when Syrians were taking to the streets in nonviolent protests and other forms of civil disobedience, the Assad regime released as many as 20,000 jihadis from prison. Now, these jihadis had been previously sent by the Assad regime to Iraq to fight the so-called American occupation, and upon their return, they were released. In 2011, the Assad regime made a big show of declaring an amnesty for these people. They weaponized them and sent them out into the peaceful protests. So I think the strategy has been in its implementation phase since the very beginning. I think what the regime and the Russians are doing now are targeting certainly the moderate armed opposition, but they've also been targeting nonviolent activists. They've been targeting the country's infrastructure. They've been targeting hospitals and schools and marketplaces. They've been targeting Doctors Without Borders. Just today in Idlib, there was an attack on a hospital. So I think the strategy absolutely is clear the country of anybody, armed or otherwise, who would be in opposition to the Assad regime, so that you can boil things down to a simple narrative, Assad versus ISIS. The problem is, for the Syrian people, Assad and ISIS are inextricably linked. We see collusion between the two groups. We see that the Russians have not been targeting ISIS. We see that Assad is not targeting ISIS. Instead, they are targeting opposition.
But what is Assad going to end up with? A statelet? If nobody's going to prepare to deal with the Islamic State, or if this whole thing is a feint to get rid of the legitimate opposition and then just leave the Islamic State as it's either me or the terrorist, which is Assad's mantra. What are you going to do about the terrorists? Who's going to deal with them? Nobody's presumably the U.S. has staked so much, even though they appear to be working, basically acceding to the Russian leadership in this. What is the end game with the Islamic State?
Well, we believe that if the Assad regime is gone, then the Islamic State has no more reason for existence, particularly in Syria. We see a very clear link between Assad's survival and the propping up of this Islamic State, or Daesh, as we like to call it. We see that they are two terrorists, two dictators, who simply look different. One is well-groomed, and the other one looks pretty ugly and scary. But at the end of the day, they are both terrorist organizations. At the end of the day, it is the Assad regime that launches chemical weapons against civilians at will, with absolutely no consequences. And at the end of the day, we know that the Assad regime has behaved in a manner that forces us to call him Syria's Hitler.
But given that the Russians and the Iranians are not going to let him fall, and they've always known all along what they want, the West has not known what they've wanted, they still don't seem to know what they want, so it's unlikely that Assad is going to fall. So then what happens to Daesh, the so-called self-declared Islamic State?
I really don't know what happens to Daesh in the absence of any real pressure on the Assad regime to step aside. Because we see such collusion between the Assad regime and Daesh, we're seeing them as being hand-in-hand partners. And so, again, our position is that if we can eliminate Assad, we can eliminate ISIS. What we're seeing is that the people on the ground are rejecting both. They're also rejecting foreign occupation in the form of Russian and Iranian and Hezbollah troops. And what the people, the civilians of Syria, are saying very clearly and very loudly is they want regime change. And so this goes back to the ongoing peace talks. the delegations from the opposition and the regime have arrived in Geneva. They're supposed to begin talks tomorrow. And, of course, the Assad regime is saying that a precondition is that the issue of regime change not be brought up at all. And they're saying they will walk out. Well, what are they there to negotiate? In the past, they have forced the negotiations to take the path of discussing humanitarian relief. So you have to understand the irony of this, that the Assad regime will impose sieges on civilian communities and then go to Geneva to discuss and negotiate the provision of food to starving civilians. They'll discuss the provision of medical attention to people who are dying of treatable illnesses, people who are literally starving to death. These are the acts of a mafia, not a legitimate government.
But just though to look at the reality as far as we can see it on the ground, it does seem that both Daesh, al-Nusra, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate, that the jihadis are winning, the moderate opposition is losing, and nobody is and that Assad has been rescued by both the Russians and the Iranians, so he's not going away. So if you're going to end up with Assad versus al-Nusra, even though they've been in collusion, as you pointed out, they don't – there's no way in the world those two groups like each other, and they're going to continue to fight presumably. So is there going to be a second Syrian war, or will there just be an acceptance of the partition of the country? And who in the world would want to live with a big chunk of Syria under the control of Daesh?
Well, nobody in the opposition is calling for partition or agreeing with the concept of partition. I don't see this as a second Syrian war. I see this as a continuation of a war that the Assad regime is waging against the people of Syria. I believe that the West has a moral obligation to step in, if for nothing else but than the humanitarian disaster. Of course, this is being called the worst humanitarian disaster since World War II. I think we're seeing a refugee crisis that is almost unparalleled, certainly since World War II, and it looks like it's not going to stop. I don't believe that Russia can support Bashar al-Assad indefinitely. I think at some point there has to be a realization about how this war is escalating and becoming more global in nature. As you see economies of other countries being disrupted, as you see the sheer humanitarian tragedy that's being played out in our time with immediate knowledge and information of this, we're all seeing this in real time, I think at some point the West is going to have to take action to remove the regime of Bashar al-Assad.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Rafif Shujati.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Rafif Shujati, who's the founder and director of the Free Syria Foundation. She's also the English language spokeswoman for the Local Coordination Committees in Syria, a grassroots network designed to align the activities of pro-democracy Syrians in each of the country's 14 governorates. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.